This week in Retronauts, chasing classic games at monstro prices. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Retronauts episode 730. That is a lot of episodes, and we just keep going because we gotta. This is our white whale, making more podcasts. I think I mentioned that I'm Jeremy Parrish, but I am not Jeremy Parrish alone. There are other people here. Actually, they're not Jeremy Parrish. So I am Jeremy Parrish alone, but I am not alone. I am Jeremy Parrish who is not alone. Anyway, it's very early in the morning. The time change did not help me at all. Guys, please bail me out here.
Hello. This is Jeremy. It's Stuart Jip. Hello. I'm here too.
All right. So it seems like everyone's being affected.
And here to share Tales of Regret, it's Kevin Bunch.
Tales of Regret. Oh, now I'm looking forward to this episode. I wasn't sure if it was worth making the effort this early in the day when I'm this tired, but yeah. It sounds like it's going to be a delightfully delirious experience. Yes, this is part two, presumably the final part, of our White Whales episode. There were so many whales last time that we only made it through the NES and Master System. And now we have to tackle portables and 16-bits and beyond. I don't have as much to say about these games as I did some of the early ones, but I also didn't think we would spend an entire hour on Atari 2600 games, so life is full of surprises, and we never know where this particular seafaring voyage is about to go. I will confess here, though, last time, episode 724... we did talk quite a bit about Little Samson, and I was like, wow, no one knows what's up with that one. And actually, what's that?
I was kayfabing.
It's also known as lying through your teeth, but that's the magic of non-disclosure agreements is that, they really encourage you to lie because otherwise you'll be in deep legal trouble and owe people a lot of money. And possibly get fired. And I don't want any of those things. So I lied like a champion. And no one guessed that Limited Run Games would announce a physical release in some capacity of Little Samson in the year of our Lord 2026, I think. I'm not actually sure what the timing on that is or all the specifics. I will say that I am involved in some capacity. And that is actually the impetus behind this topic. Not that I'm trying to promote an upcoming sale, but that being kind of in the sphere of awareness of Little Samson, I started going to, you know, the usual round of conventions this year, and I kept seeing it on the show floor at the shops for anywhere between like $2,500 loose to $12,000 boxed and complete. And it got me thinking not only about, wow, that was a lot of money, but also about all the other games that are crazy expensive and how so few of them are actually worth paying anything for. And thus we are talking about White Whales. So that is my deep, soulful confession. And now that I have shattered your trust in me, we can move forward and you can listen to people who are probably more honest than me.
Oh, no.
No? Okay. But at least you're honest about not being honest, which means maybe you actually are honest because you say you're dishonest. Oh, my God. It's a paradox. It's a twister. One of us tells the truth. One of us always lies.
I may ask one question.
You may ask one question. All right. Go for it. What is your question?
When will we see the reissue of Red Sea Crossing? From the first episode. Obviously, that's the question on everyone's mind.
I'm sure once the Christian nationalists take over the government completely, that'll be top on their list of things to do. Reissue Red Sea Crossing for every child. That's the only game you're allowed to play. Goodbye. Good night, Fortnite.
Have they put Jesus in Fortnite yet? Because he's coming. Like, I guarantee it. We got the Simpsons. That's like the
not yet, but I feel
thing.
Like when they reveal them, it's going to be that Rio de Janeiro statue looking down over the world of Fortnite. Yeah. Look forward to it, kids.
And Jesus just rips his arms off the cross and is like, where are we dropping, boys? I mean, disciples. And then it's just like, I don't know. I've got this whole thing in my head.
No, I think you should write to Epic and say, gents, I have a spectacular idea for you. Mm. Public domain, you don't even have to license the character. He's out there, free to use.
Maybe he would emerge if I did that. You know, maybe the second coming would take
that
place.
That would cause the rapture.
Yeah.
Stuart, we are doing a rapture now just because we're so angry at you that you are going to be the only one left behind.
I knew that would happen.
Yep. It'll be like that Twilight Zone episode where you'll break your glasses and you can't read anything, even though you don't actually wear glasses.
No, not at the moment, though I still can't read.
They can be anybody's glasses, really.
It's true. Go from talking about Jesus to the anti-Jesus Kid Dracula. That's right, we're talking about the Game Boy family now. Game Boy, Game Boy Color. And actually, I don't think there are any stupid expensive games on Game Boy Advance or games that cost too much, but I'm not aware of anything on Game Boy Advance that is soared to stratospheric prices. It's just not a system that that seems to have engendered a lot of super rarities, which is actually kind of strange because it's one of those systems that had a really long life and you would think some of the tail end stuff would get pricey, but the tail end stuff is, you know, a few hundred bucks complete.
Yeah. There's a few, like, I mean, not to do the limited run games plug again, but like Ninja 5-0 was up to like nearly 1,000 basically, before, and then it got re-released. It's probably still up there. I think the most expensive is Pocky and Rocky when it's still like new.
Oh, sealed. Right. Pocky and Rocky and Becky.
Yeah. I don't know who this Becky character is, but
she's the lady in Baby Got Back that they mentioned. Oh, my God, Becky.
Oh, okay. Yeah, of course it is. Should have known.
No, it's a tie-in with Sir Mix-a-Lot, yes.
Oh, okay.
That is a little-known fact.
Yeah, the Sir Mix-a-Lot Taito overlap, the Venn diagram, is just a circle.
I'm enjoying
the Zuntata difference.
Of this episode. This is a very funny episode so far. I'm enjoying this.
Oh, good. Good. Yeah. I should sleep too little more often. the Game Boy family... You know, Game Boy, I have a fondness for because that was what got me into making videos. I said, oh, I should do a complete chronology of all video games for Game Boy released all around the world, which, you know, not a stupid idea at all. But it actually seemed manageable because I looked at prices of software and boxed complete games in 2014 and said, of all the systems that I really enjoy, Game Boy is the most reasonably priced. There were only a few games that I was aware of, you know, looking at eBay sales and that sort of thing, that had unreasonable prices, which, you know, at the time were $800, $900. And I said, you know what? I can do this. I can do this. I'm on a games journalist salary, but I can do this. Whereas NES, Super NES, not a chance. So I started, and then all of a sudden, people said, oh, Game Boy, very cheap to collect. I'm going to own everything. And it became a very popular system for collectors, and all of a sudden, prices shot way up. And the funny thing is that the games that in the beginning were the most expensive, they haven't really gone up in price that much. So stuff like Sumo Fighter and Fish Dude, which, you know, I looked at and said, oh, it's going to be rough. They still cost about, you know, $600 to $900 complete, which, you know, that's a lot of money for a Game Boy game. But in 10 years, their prices haven't really budged that I can tell. But there are other games that have just shot way up as people have said, holy crap, I can't find this game. I need to find this game. There's some things out there that I actually couldn't get data on because I can't find recent sales of them. like Captain America and the Avengers. I know someone who's been looking for that game for Game Boy for a very long time. And as far as I know, there have been no sales of it in a long, long time. So who knows what that is worth now? I probably just made life harder for him by mentioning the fact that it is inaccessible for tens of thousands of people. Please don't make life harder for my friend. But there are three games that I want to call out on Game Boy and Game Boy Color. And, you know, these are not on the level price-wise of something like Red Sea Crossing or the entire Neo Geo AES library, but they're still up there. And one of them is actually the reason that one of the reasons I had to kind of bow out of doing Game Boy for a while and put the brakes on it, and that is Amazing Tater, the sequel to it was called Puzzle Boy in Japan. I just totally blanked out on it.
Quirk? Is it Quirk?
Yes, Quirk. No,
right.
Yeah. No. You start out as a tomato, and then the sequel, he's a potato.
Yeah, like
potato,
that saying,
tomato. I don't think that was the inspiration there, but it would have been a pretty good little bit for a script if I had gotten there. But the problem is, that Amazing Tater now sells, according to price charting, for about $4,100 complete. And that is a lot. It was expensive back in the day, but not that expensive. And actually, I had something worked out with Atlas's head of PR when I was in the press, where I was going to do an office visit at some point, and he was going to let me photograph some of the rarer games in the Atlas library. But then he left the company, and that fell through. So never trust PR folks. They will break your heart. But Amazing Tater, really expensive. And I feel like that is not because it's probably somewhat rare, but it's not like some late period, you know, Game Boy Lacuna game that was only produced in minimal quantities and no one bought it. I think it's just the Atlas thing. Atlas, like the Persona and Shin Megami Tensei, but especially Persona fans are just, they just drive up the price on anything that has the Atlas label on it. Rockin' Cats, Run Saber, like Tale Concerto. I mean, Tale Concerto, you can understand. That's got the Atlas and the furry contingent going for it. And also the people who like Mega Man Legends. So it's like the triple threat. But Amazing Tater, furries don't care. They don't want to be potatoes. They want to be cats. And the Mega Man Legends people don't care because what do potatoes have to do with Mega Man? Nothing. There is no Tuber Man. So I don't know. Amazing Tater, a puzzle game, amazing price.
Oil Man plus Flame.
Do we have thoughts on Amazing Tater?
I think you hit the nail on the head with the Atlas aspect there, because I'm blanking because there were a couple other Atlas games that I know have blown up in price, maybe not to this extent, but I think actually we have at least one of them also on this list.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Which one is that, so I can check it out next time I'm at your place?
I mean on your list of games here. Okay. But also, yeah, I do have a copy. It's Jack Brothers, but...
Oh, yeah, okay. I've been there, done that. I don't need it.
Yeah, but yeah. Oh, I've messed with this a little bit. I have seen loose copies in stores of this before from, like, a decade ago. And this is one of them that I'm like, wow, I can't believe this got so expensive. I'm kind of kicking myself for passing it by when it was only a little unreasonably priced.
But who could have predicted? Whomst among us could have known?
The kids yearn for potatoes.
It's one of those things I find kind of funny, which is that you get something that is as rare and desirable as this game, and it is called Amazing Tater of all things. Not even Amazing Potato, you know, just Amazing Tater. I like that very much.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I'm going to describe my Thanksgiving dinner.
It could also be a game about Suntarans. So the next on the list is an understandably expensive game, although it's hard to understand exactly how it's this expensive. But that game is a tie-in to the Castlevania series that Konami never stopped to say, hey, everyone, here's a tie-in to the Castlevania series. So it came out in America with no obvious indications that it was a Castlevania game. And years later, Castlevania fans said, well, we're not getting new Castlevania games. Let's go raid history for the old ones. Wait a minute, what's this? Kid Dracula? That's right, it's Kid Dracula, which price charting says now sells for $2,500 complete. And that makes me very sad that a few years ago when I saw it for $999 complete at a convention, I did not buy it to flip. But again, this whole episode is about regrets.
Yeah, I mean, I was quite excited when I saw this because I've got this. Not complete, I hasten to add. I found this at random when I was much younger in like a sort of toy fair thing that they have in the UK sometimes. And they just some guy just randomly had a basket of Game Boy games. And I was like, cool. Because they were so cheap back then, really. The real problem was finding any at all. The price wasn't really the issue. So I'm looking through this, like all of these GB games, and they have some sort of rare ones like Metal Gear Solid and Resident Evil Gaiden. But I think £20 is the most expensive they were. But they had a Kid Dracula for $8, which is about $12, I think. And I was like, it's just loose, but it's Kid Dracula. And it is the USA version as well, which apparently is something like $170, which is really not as much as $2,500. It's quite a bit lower. But nevertheless, I will be hanging on to it as it appreciates in value and becomes more and more vintage. It helps that it's also actually really good. It's better than It's better than the Famicom one, I think. It's a lot of fun.
Really? Yeah, there are no stupid quizzes in the Game Boy version.
I could see that making it better. I haven't gone through the Famicom game. The quiz does kind of slow all of the rhythms of the game.
Yeah. It's annoying. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, this is really quite tangential, to be honest. It reminds me very much of the other sort of Konami platformers of the time, like the Tiny Toon Adventures games that they put out on the Game Boy, which are really rather good as well. It has a similar feel to that, where it's sort of set PC, but in a way that works because it's so quick and it's so short that you're just kind of getting thrown into sort of situation after situation. The way we'll say it is a bit weird because I'm reasonably certain the first boss is kind of like this kind of grand wizard clan guy with a sort of reverse swastika on his head.
Mm-hmm. A reverse swastika is just called a manji. He's actually okay. Meant to be some sort of, it's not meant to be clan at all. It's meant to be something drawn from more like Buddhist lore.
Okay. So, yeah, that's different. The imagery, however, it's striking.
It's a little rough. If you are not expecting it, and
yeah,
it's one of those things that just kind of accidentally coincides with bad stuff that you wouldn't necessarily know about.
But you're Kid Dracula. You're beating up on the potential clansmen.
That's true. It's like Golgo 13 shooting Hitler in the face multiple times because he's been cloned.
Yeah.
With Dracula, I guess there's kind of shades of grey, because on the one hand, drains the blood of virgins, on the other hand, not racist, apparently, which,
You take the good with the bad.
Hither and thither.
I mean, he's Kid Dracula. I don't know that he was into the blood draining yet.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
That might have been he hit puberty, and then he takes an interest in the bloody virgins or whatever you were talking about.
Well, he throws something at you and turns you into a coin, which isn't great either, really, but, I'm not having... Well, it's fine. It's Dracula.
It sounds like a parable to me. Like, this is because of your greed, your love of money.
Yes, I see it. Yeah, that's very true.
Mm-hmm. This was, 93, 94, thereabouts?
Yeah, it was a bit on the later side, but still before the Game Boy totally crashed. I mean, it would have been contemporary with something like Zelda on Game Boy, and that was kind of... And Super Game Boy came out around that time, so... There was kind of a resurgence of interest in Game Boy around the time that Kid Dracula came out. So Konami could have had a slam dunk and said, hey, sorry about the Castlevania Adventure or Castlevania the Adventure. That was pretty bad. But this one's really good. Please buy it.
Yeah,
but no, they didn't.
Sort of understandably, the Konami games, not to this sort of scale, but they do tend to fetch somewhat higher prices than... than other platformers. They are, because they are just a higher quality and better. I know that, there's that game Zen Intergalactic Ninja, which is a Konami, Game Boy game, which is reasonably pricey. And the later, the last Turtles game, Radical Rescue, that one cost a packet. It's one of my, it's one of my slightly more regrettable purchases when I had money. It's like, yeah, you know what? I got it. It's Turtles. I got it. But then they did the Cowabunga collection, rendering it all moot.
I was just thinking, you know, this is the same time frame for the Mega Man 4 and 5 Game Boy releases, and those are also expensive. So I think there's just, like, an overlap between, all right, this is a third-party Game Boy game, not produced in massive, like, Nintendo first-party quantities. And also, it's from a known, like, quality company. Yep. And also, it's from a major, like, game franchise that is very collectible. So I think all of those come together to make Kid Dracula wallet-busting.
I was a little surprised it wasn't on the Castlevania Anniversary Collection with the Famicom version of Kid Dracula, because it's, like I say, it's the better game. I mean, I guess they can't put them all on there, but why? Like, just put them all on there?
I feel like they must be rationing them out.
Yeah.
And I actually do not have insider information on this, despite Limited Run having published some of those collections. But I just feel like there are some notable absences, like Castlevania Legends, which, you know, given the price on that one, it would be worthwhile. It would behoove Konami to make that readily available for people. And it's not like Game Boy emulation is some mystery that no one understands. They could do it.
If it was like a Taito game, they probably would have made it like a pre-order exclusive on Amazon or something. Just that one game. And it's the only way to get it ever.
Yeah.
Hey, in like 5 years, they'll put it out on virtual console or whatever, the eShop.
Anyway, I'm glad you mentioned Zen Intergalactic Ninja. It is not one of the games that qualifies for this list because it only sells for 600 complete. Mm. But it is one of my regrets because about 10 years ago, I was shopping in Old Town Ellicott City, visiting my sister-in-law's family. And I came across a copy complete in box at just some random shop, like a game and toy shop, for $40. And I said, wow, that seems like a pretty good price. I should grab this. So I got it. And then after I photographed it, I said, it's going to be a lot while before I get to this. I don't really need to keep it around. So I sold it to Chris Kohler for, I think, the price that I bought it for. So Chris got a really great deal and saved like $500 on Zen Intergalactic Ninja because of his friend Jeremy. And now he owes me forever. Anyway, the one other Game Boy game I wanted to touch on is a Game Boy Color game, and that one is the original Shantae, which, despite having been reissued in cartridge form and being readily available on every major platform now, thanks again to Limited Run Games, this is not an advertisement, I swear to God, that still sells complete for $2,100 or possibly more, $2,150 maybe. And, you know, that is one of those games you can understand why it soared in price, because it is from the very tail end of the Game Boy Color's life, by which point everyone had said, yeah, I'm done with this color stuff. I want to get to Advance. I'm sick of buying these old games. Everything on Game Boy Color is baby games for stupid people, bad license games, which, you know, was not true, but understandable why people would have that perception. So for some weird reason, Capcom had this initiative where they were like, let's publish some Game Boy Color games from other creators that are going to sink at retail and just do horribly. So they published Shantae, Tokitori, Metal Fighter or something like that. There were like three or four Game Boy Color games that all came out around the same time from Konami or from Capcom. And they just went nowhere because these were not like games tied to existing properties. They were original properties. And there was no indication that, hey, these are actually really good. They are from Capcom. You can trust them. They would not publish crap. But no, those games sank. And then people years later realized, whoa, Shantae, really good, kind of a proto-Metroidvania. Sequels started to come out a decade later. And the series soared in popularity. And also, Shantae the character sailed in popularity because she's scantily clad, buxom, and underaged, which I think she's underaged, which has an appeal to a certain kind of gamer. So, you know, there's a certain contingent of fans that's just like, hell yeah, Shantae, I will buy anything with Shantae. And so, of course, they, you know, want to get their hands on the original, the origin point of the series, which exists in small numbers, scarce quantities, and is very, very expensive now.
I should add, possibly for the purposes of legal reprisal, they've come out and said that she's not underage, specifically.
Oh, okay.
They said, no, the person who said that was an intern, and they were wrong. She is definitely not underage, okay? Have at it, everybody. She's not underage. It's fine.
Okay.
They didn't say, well, have at it. That was my embellishment. But.
I was going to say, is that part of the statement in the press release?
It's the foreword for the art book. Have at it, everyone.
I remember reading about this one in the magazines at the time and being really interested in it, but I could never find a copy locally. Even the stores that stocked all of the like really weird and limited print run games like Suikoden 2 and whatnot, they did not stock Shantae. I did not see this until like the late 2000s when I found a copy for like $300, and I'm like, oh man, I don't have $300. I'll just have to get it next time. And well, The next time was when Limited Run did their reissue.
Did you get the reissue though?
I did get the reissue.
Okay. That's good to hear.
I'm almost certain, and there's a small chance this is a false memory, that I remember seeing this on the shelf back when it first came out in Game, which is like the UK's version of, I don't know, EB or something, when they had literally one shelf with three Game Boy Color games on it at all. Everything else was just the rest. And I'm almost certain I saw this and just was like, oh, well, there's that game that got like reasonably good reviews. Unfortunately, I don't own a Game Boy, so I'm just going to leave it there and not buy it for £30 new in sealed and keep it that way for another 20 years. It's yeah, it's a shame.
Yeah, I'm wanting to say that I ordered this through mail order. I think I was doing pretty much all my shopping by mail order at this point, like, you know, pre-order from a retailer like CompUSA or something. And I was the weirdo who was still buying Game Boy Color games. So I ended up getting all of the Konami stuff or Capcom stuff that was released. And of course, I have none of it anymore because I've moved across the country multiple times and had to divest myself of all my physical possessions repeatedly. So, yeah, my $30 investment has not paid off in rewards. It has not paid off in spades. So I have nothing to show for being an early adopter for Shantae. Besides, you know, being able to say, I was there at the start and I like her because she's a character in a Game Boy Color game and from an era where no one else was caring about Game Boy Color, and I respect that. It doesn't have anything to do with her being buxom, scantily clad, and possibly underage. Anyway, that's Game Boy for you. How about Game Gear? That's your ear category, Stuart. Why don't you walk us through this one? Actually, this is
Game Gear. No,
this is the Stuart Jip game. This is your moment right here. Please shine.
Yeah, this is the moment for me. Yeah. Well, we're talking about Fantastic Dizzy, which is one of the most accurately named games ever made. No, it's not actually. It's fun. Okay, you all know how I feel about Dizzy, I'm sure. He's a little egg. He walks around, he picks things up, and you gotta give those things to other people or use those things with other people or whatever to solve puzzles. But you can only carry three of the things at a time, so you gotta keep leaving things lying around and sort of basically littering everywhere. Which is great when you've got these reasonably small kind of worlds to explore. Fantastic Dizzy, though, it does not have a small world at all. It's enormous. It's really, really big. It's like 200 screens or something. I still measure games by screens, by the way, even when they're scrolling. That's just my way. So you have to not only interact with something like probably like 100 or so items to solve the puzzles in the games. You've got to remember where you put them. And it's not just even a big open map. There are interior areas you can go into as well. So you can leave something in a room, forget that it's there forever, and walk around going, where the hell is this? this thing that I know I need. Where the hell did I leave it? It's a kind of get a notepad, draw a map, and label the map for Christ's sake kind of a game. Which, you know, if you grew up with a Spectrum, it's just like, fine, yeah, sure, let's go. I'm not going to finish this anyway, who cares? You know? I'm here for it. So it's a very good game that I would really quite strongly advise that you don't play first if you're interested in jumping into this series, because it's like almost like a culmination of the whole thing. They threw a load of things from previous Dizzy games into it. It's like a best of Dizzy kind of thing. It's got like the mini games like Bubble Dizzy, Dizzy Down the Rapids. These were all individual Spectrum games, but they're just mini games now. And it's good. It's a good game. Really, really difficult to recommend, but it's a good game. And on the Game Gear, it's fine. It's one of those games that boots into Master System mode, you know? So it's not really a Game Gear game. It's a Master System game that just runs on the Game Gear. I'm not sure exactly how that works, because when I went and did the Game Gear directory, which you can read now on the Retronauts website, by the way, reviews of every single Western Game Gear game, it took me ages. Lots of fun, though. Lots of fun. There's quite a lot of swearing in it, but, you know, I'm sure you're used to that by now. There were a few games that just are Master System games. They just display as Master System games. You can tell by the look of them that they're not really Game Gear games. If you launch those as ROMs in an emulator, they will boot in the Master System resolution rather than Game Gear. It's just odd. I don't really understand it, but the directory is not a technical manual. I haven't looked into this yet, but I will. Would I recommend spending $1,800 on it? No, I wouldn't. quite fervently, I don't advise you do that when this game is available on the NES, the Mega Drive, and most microcomputers for what I would imagine is a much more reasonable price. On the Mega Drive, in fact, you can get a cartridge that has Fantastic Dizzy and Cosmic Spacehead on the same cartridge for less than £20, and that's two good games right there.
And if you want to play it on the go like Game Gear, you can just get it on a Nomad and you're still spending less than the Game Gear cartridge.
Just get it on a Sega Nomad like everyone does. Like, you know, come on. Yeah, not sure what's happened there. I don't even think it's the only expensive Game Gear Dizzy game, because there's also the Excellent Dizzy Collection, which is also misnamed.
Is that okay? That is actually its name, Excellent Dizzy Collection.
It's called the Excellent Dizzy Collection.
So that was not you editorializing.
No, when you boot it up, this voice goes like, "Let me try and do it." It goes, "The Excellent Dizzy Collection." It sounds exactly like that. I think it's probably just like someone who worked in the canteen at Codemasters or something did it. You know, one of these days I'll get some kind of Dizzy interview and I'll crack this egg.
Hey. But,
yeah, there you go. Yeah.
I don't know. You're probably on a blacklist.
Oh, God. I probably am, actually, because I've probably told this one, but the Oliver twins who designed Dizzy Games, created Dizzy, when I met them at this thing, at this event, and there was like doing Q&A, and I asked them about, I think it's Magic Land Dizzy. When you go in, Daisy is Dizzy's egg girlfriend, obviously, I'm sure you knew. But in her house, one of the items you can find is a whip. It's just that's the only item in there. And I was like, so when you put the whip in Daisy's house, was that like a sort of a joke, like an adult kind of joke? And they didn't look very happy. And they were like, oh, no, we would never do something like that. We didn't develop that game. We would never do something like that. We would never put any offensive content in a Dizzy game. And I'm like,
I mean, it's not necessarily offensive. Like, they're consenting adult eggs, I'm sure.
No, I'm sure they are.
Actually, I guess by definition, eggs are not adults. So never mind.
That was also the day when I held the original Dizzy source code discs in my hands, and I just thought to myself, like the call of the void in my head going, this would be really funny if you just smash them. Like, you could be the person who goes down in retro gaming notoriety as having pointlessly destroyed a piece of history. It's all, I think about it so often, what I could have done.
Hey guys, would you like to see my amazing Dizzy fridge magnets?
Yeah, I would like to see them, actually. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, you know,
what a letdown.
You know, I remember it was years ago, I went on like a Dizzy kick and was looking for the different versions of Dizzy games. And I remember looking at the Game Gear ones like, oh, it would be cool to have like a portable Dizzy. Oh my God, these prices. I don't care about Dizzy that much.
Fantastic Dizzy on Game Gear, now that I think about it. Playing that on the Game Gear screen for that long when it doesn't have any kind of password and it's actually quite a long, difficult game, it sounds like a rare kind of hell, actually. I can't be doing with that.
Yeah. I mean, you'll outlast the batteries.
Yeah.
Really.
Oh, absolutely. There's no way you could beat it without plugging in the adapter, I'd have thought. burn through, what, 6, 8 batteries? I can't remember how many it took. Was it just 4?
It was 6.
Oh, it was 6. Good lord. Wasn't even... That's ridiculous. It's not at all worth it for Dizzy, honestly. Not for that Dizzy. Just play it on the NES. It's probably not that expensive on the NES, right? That's a really good
version. No, isn't that one of those Comerica games for the Aladdin Deck Enhancer?
I think in America, yes. The one that shipped with it was Dizzy the Adventurer, which is a redo of Dizzy Prince of the Oak Folk, and it's probably my favorite Dizzy game, so, you know, get that one down. Yeah, that's only like 40 screens. That's very doable.
This week in Retronauts, it's Stuart talking about Dizzy games, and again. That's all.
I think I already did a Dizzy episode and just told all of those same stories, so I apologize for doing the best of.
That's okay. That's what people get for not listening to your previous podcast. If they listen, you wouldn't have to reek. Some monsters.
People should appreciate Dizzy more for all its weirdness.
Yeah, if you don't listen to every single episode of this podcast, then honestly, what are you doing? Like, it's honestly.
So far we've had a tomato talking about potatoes, an egg. We're pulling together an entire meal of rare video games here. So that's very exciting to me.
Yeah, we're putting together a full English breakfast. We just need a game about sausage and bacon.
Mm. There's probably some of those out there.
But they don't cost $2,000.
We'll get to Tomba eventually. So that was it for Game Gear. There is another handheld I want to talk about that is a little fuzzy. Like, I had trouble getting actual numbers on this, and that's the Neo Geo Pocket. Specifically, the Pocket, not the color. And specifically, the European Neo Geo Pocket lineup. Because SNK released, you know, two versions of the hardware. There was the Neo Geo Pocket, which had like 9 games for it, and they were all monochrome. And it came out at the same time as the Game Boy Color. Bad news for SNK, so they said, all right, back to the drawing board, and they produced very quickly a color variation of the system, and that ended up having like 70 games for it before a gambling company took over SNK and said, well, these handheld systems have great little screens that would work really well in our pachinko machines. We don't care about your video games. We'll publish some pachinko games for you, but no, we're just going to dismantle you literally for parts. But there is that brief window of the 9 Neo Geo Pocket Color or Neo Geo Pocket games before color, 6 or 7 of which came out in Europe in vanishingly tiny quantities. And I think there were also American releases, but that might have just been stuff that was shuttled over from a different region and sold direct to consumer from SNK's website, which who was doing that in 1998? Not a lot of people. Mm. Even I saw it and I said, this is a very ramshackle looking website. I don't want to give them my credit card number. I just got this credit card. It's brand new to me. I can't give it away. So I missed out on those American releases. Who knows what they are actually like? But the European releases, very hard to come by, I think, because I went looking for price charting data, and the numbers that I came up with seem inaccurate. Like, you had, I believe, Samurai Showdown, King of Fighters R1, you know, Baseball Stars, a soccer game or football, if you prefer, tennis game. And from what I understand, those are just like insanely hard to find complete in box. But yeah, the numbers I came up with were not, they don't seem to reflect that. So I don't know what's going on there. But in my experience, like actually trying to do a Neo Geo Pocket focused video series, I gave up, you know, the European releases as a fool's game.
Yeah.
But I don't know what the deal is there. Stuart, can you speak to this?
Well, honestly, anecdotally, I mean, I used to have a fair number of Neo Geo Pocket Color games. It didn't have a really huge footprint, but you did see them. You found them around. And I honestly can't remember ever seeing one of the non-color games ever anywhere, loose or otherwise. It just did not show up. Not for. I mean, I only looked in stores, and usually thrift stores where they would turn up, or game stores that sold secondhand Neo Geo games, or sorry, Pocket Color games, or color, or just Pocket. And I don't recall ever seeing one of the black and white games in my life. I had a fair number of these, and I did not see them. I would imagine that they are quite hard to find. I guess the issue is, honestly, maybe they're just not that desirable by comparison, which is kind of a shame, because I'm assuming that either almost all of them or all of them were re-released as color games. I know, like, King of Fighters certainly was, Samurai Showdown, right? No?
No, Samurai Showdown and King of Fighters, both the color versions are different games.
Oh, I'm thinking Showdown of R2. Too. Wow, that's
R2. So those are unique releases.
Right, wow, okay. Well, then that does surprise me more, because then they definitely would be desirable. Unique King of Fighters and Samurai Showdown games, yeah. The only Neo Geo Pocket color game I know that goes to the went to silly prices was Pocket Reversi, which was just over $5,000. But that again, that's a color game. And I think that was released in really, really small quantity. It's like a not really known level of smallness. But everything else I remember you could get for about the most you'd probably pay is about $50 back then. Not dollars, pounds, but, you know. They have gone up now, and I'm a little bit upset about it, because I sold all of my Neo Geo Pocket games, and they were all like complete clamshell. They were gorgeous, those clamshell cases they put out for those. Mm-hmm. But I remember going into like Game Station, and they had them for like $1.99, like $4 each, complete, like buy one, get one free, just all of these Neo Geo Pocket color games. I'm like, yeah, I'll take those. Metal Slug 1-2, all the King of Fighters, like Capcom versus SNK, all that stuff. Card Fighters, let's go. And then later I sold them all for a lot more than $4, but a lot less than what they go for now, so I'm kind of like sitting on my hands a bit in shame. Though I do still have Sonic complete, and I looked in CEX this weekend and someone was selling it for £200, so I was like, okay, that's another one of my pension games, I'll sit on that for a while.
Yeah, I remember being into like Neo Geo Pocket stuff back in high school, and I remember hearing about the European releases of a lot of these things, but I don't think I ever saw them like up for sale online, or certainly not locally. Although there were stores that imported a lot of games, for the most part, they were sticking to the Japanese imports for Neo Geo Pocket. Yeah, that's interesting that the prices are kind of all over the place. I wonder if it's because the games themselves, like, that they'll just shift what language they are based on their system settings and that sort of thing. So, you know, at that point, if you're getting a loose copy, like, it doesn't really matter what the label is, because you're going to still be able to play the game in English.
Yeah, but, you know, the hardcore collectors really care about whether it's got an ESRB label on it, Cero, or PEGI. Like, that's the most important thing in the world to some people when they buy a game and spend a lot of money on it. We'll talk about that later with the regular Neo Geo. But, yeah, I don't know. Like, I'm having a hard time with Neo Geo here. And maybe what Stuart said about them just not being desirable is correct. You know, when I put together my first NES era book and pulled together those collections of pre-NES Japanese consoles, some of those games were really hard to come by. Really, really hard. Like, browsing Japanese auction sites, American auction sites, online shops, just digging around. Some of those took years to find. And most of them were not expensive when I did find them. It's just, like, they're super rare. No one cares about them. But also, no one wants them. So they're not expensive. It's just good luck, you know, someone saying, oh, here's, you know, some random Bandai Arcadia game I'm going to sell. So, you know, you have that to contend with. It's not just like, what do collectors think they can get? It's like, do they think it's worth even putting this thing up for sale? Is it going to get enough to bother with? So, yeah, money, it's evil. It's terrible. The worst.
Yeah. I remember a couple years ago, someone finally got the last couple games for the Japanese RCA Studio 2 release, which had exclusive games, like a sumo game and like some other weird stuff. And they're like, all right, we can finally dump these games. But they weren't that expensive, but they did not show up for auction or anything for like 20 odd years.
That's how they do.
Yeah. The Neo Geo Pocket Color, again, I don't know if this happened in the US, but I do find it kind of funny, the turnaround on it from the absolute sort of apathy towards the thing from consumers. Like, I remember they re-released it, but it was almost, it was like a blister pack. You got
the
system.
Yeah, they put it on blister cards.
They did.
Yeah.
And it was like, you got like 8 games, and it was like all the amazing games, you know, like all the King of Fighters, the Capcom, this, and you could get the whole thing for like £40, like maybe 50, new. And I remember just looking at that and going, wow, that thing failed really badly, and I'm not spending the money on it, you know, which I really wish I had now because I miss it. But
yeah, at the risk of turning this into a Neo Geo Pocket episode, which, you know, that's fine. A big part of that was just that SNK was in arrears at that point. They were really struggling financially. They didn't have the money to promote the system the way it deserved. And then when they sold the company, their new lords and master, Aruz, just didn't care. So that was when Aruz was like, we've got these warehouses of video games and systems. Let's just clear them out. Get these over to GameStop as cheaply as possible, just get them out, liquidation, got to make some money back on this purchase. And that's what happened. Mm. But yeah, now those are, some of them are very, very expensive. It's very sad.
It's nice that in the last few years, I think it was Code Mystics did get about 16 to 20 of these out on like PC, Switch, etc. in the collections. And as the individual releases, I think the main fighting games are all available. Like, I know Gals Fighters, they did separately as well because it was like one of the outstanding ones. I mean, I think they even did Mega Man, Brockman Battle and Fighters, which is a lot of fun. But nobody has released a re-released Sonic Pocket Adventure, which baffles me because it's Sonic. It would definitely do some numbers, and it's a really, really good game.
I think Sega wanted to do X number of numbers, and maybe it wouldn't do that. I don't know.
Probably.
I'm surprised with all the other cotton stuff that's gotten reissued. No one's put out the Neo Geo Pocket one again because that was a very good port.
Yeah, that was the Fantastic Night Dreams one. Yeah.
It's the first one, and it's like it's you know remixed a little bit for the Neo Geo Pocket, but like it's a stellar little shooter. I remember playing a ton of that back in school.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, there are still enough unreissued games worth playing on Neo Geo Pocket that they could easily do a third Neo Geo Pocket Color collection with 10 games, 11 games, and, you know, there wouldn't be a bad game on it. Like, the you know, that system had, what, 80 games total? And at least half of them are rock solid to masterpieces. Mm-hmm. That's a great hit rate, you know. And I think that accounts a lot for why the system has shot up in collector value, because people appreciate the fact that, hey, these are good games and they are still worth playing. And even if they are, you know, still accessible through modern platforms, there is something appealing about playing them on the original hardware. Especially, you know, when you turn it on, it does that little song and the Neo Geo logo spins into place as you turn it on. Great stuff. Great stuff.
And then there's mine where the battery is dead. So whenever I turn it on, it does the it makes me redo the date and set everything up again.
One day you'll remember to get the new battery.
No, I won't. I won't, Kevin. I'll never remember to do it.
I'll send you one.
Okay.
I'm going to express mail international. Here's a 50 cent battery.
I'll be like, cool, thanks. And then I'll just like, I'll do that at some point, and then it will sit on the shelf for 1,000 years, like the Neo Geo itself.
Typical.
Yeah.
So Neo Geo Pocket Color, very rare, but also rare, we have the next, not handheld, but portable system that's going to wrap this up for us in terms of the portables, and that's Virtual Boy. And I'll be curious to see how Virtual Boy game values shift once the Nintendo Switch Online that whole thing comes out. It's going to be weird. But I'm curious to know, because some of the really rare games are being put on NSO, and it will be interesting to see if their values drop or if people suddenly say, damn, virtual bowling is genuinely good, and the price skyrockets. So stay tuned, kids. But what happened with Virtual Boy is, well, it was a massive failure, and Nintendo didn't even sustain it for a full year before clearing it out. In Japan, they shut down, I think they shut down manufacturing at the end of 1995. And so at the very tail end of 1995, you had like four games that came out in, I think, extremely small quantities and barely showed up anywhere. And when I say extremely small, I mean like three, maybe four digit numbers, like crazy small. You know, you consider that this is a Nintendo system, and therefore there is going to be some minimal threshold of collector interest. There are just not enough copies of these games to go around for everyone who wants a complete Virtual Boy worldwide collection, which, you know, 22 games, you think, I can do that, 22 games, no problem. But then you discover that some of those 22 games sell for upwards of $2,000 to $3,000 a piece, and all of a sudden you start to question the wisdom and folly of this path you've chosen to lead. So as far as I'm aware, at the very top of the pecking order for prices for Virtual Boy is Virtual Bowling. Now, price charting says this sells for $1,100 complete, but that's not based on any actual sales data. There are no recorded sales. If you look on eBay, there are people trying to sell Virtual Bowling for $10,000. And I think that is based on hopes, dreams, prayers for a desperate collector. I don't think it's realistic. So the actual price is probably somewhere between $1,100 and $10,000, which, you know, that's a lot of money for a game that is it's a bowling game, and there's another bowling game on Virtual Boy, Nestor's Funky Bowling, which not only has a, I don't know if I'd say popular, but a recognizable character for Nintendo fans attached to it and his horrible sister. But, you know, it only sells for like $200 to $300 complete. So you could have that really affordably, but people do want the Virtual Bowling because, unlike Nestor's Funky Bowling, it's a genuinely really good bowling simulation. It's from Athena, who they know their bowling games. The Goddess of Wisdom, her wisdom, like she spent those wisdom points entirely on bowling mastery. It's a weird character build choice, but I respect it. Have either of you played this?
A little bit. Like, you know.
Well, there you go.
Kind of flash cart, but.
Ah, it's okay. We'll never tell. Yeah. I think you are allowed to use flashcards if the price of a cartridge is equivalent to your mortgage payment.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
that's we'll actually within the law. Yeah.
We'll get into that on the 16-bit ones for sure.
It was
a perfectly cromulent bowling game. I enjoyed it. It's ridiculous that it is so expensive, but you know, you kind of laid out why. it's one of those funny things where, you know, rare games have a reputation of being kind of crummy, and I feel like everything we've talked about so far on this particular episode kind of goes against the grain on that. Like, maybe not the next game.
Well, there was Dizzy.
There was well,
Fish Dude.
Fish Dude.
Yeah.
Fish Dude's pretty good.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't realize. I just don't like the sound of it because, you know,
it sounds terrible, but it did inspire me to do a little Big Lebowski bit for my video, which was fun.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, that's worthwhile.
There's only one fish dude in video games, and his name is James Pond. Thanks.
Yeah, most of these games have been pretty good. Although, now we have the game that is definitively not good. It's not even finished, and that is Virtual Lab, the second rarest Virtual Boy game, which price charting sells for $2,370 as kind of the median price. And that's pretty accurate. Although, again, this is one of those good luck actually finding it. There are usually one or two copies up on eBay that are priced at about four times what it's actually worth. Just, you know, putting the lure out there, the fish dude trying to get to bait his hook. Virtual Lab is terrible. It is not a complete game. It is a bad, ugly, offensive, grating puzzle game that, like, the puzzle mechanics aren't really well thought through. But thanks to Gaming Hell, the Bad Game Hall of Fame, they did an interview with the creator of this game, who, it turns out, was in, it sounds like kind of one of those abusive employee-employer relationships you sometimes hear about happening in Japan, which seem like, you know, this is just made up stuff, but you hear enough about it that it seems like sometimes people do get away with some really horrible things. But apparently the creator of this game was forced to program this game in the course of a weekend, never having worked on Virtual Boy hardware or this processor before. They had to get it put together in time for them to clear the manufacturing cutoff deadline from Nintendo and get the game out by the end of the year. So their employer said, make this game, get it out. And they did, and it's not polished or really complete. There's, you know, some features in the game that seem like they should do something and they don't. And it's really easy to get into a stuck state where you can't win or end the game. And the graphics are pretty offensive. You're supposed to be connecting pipes, but they're like worms. And so it's just like you're putting together throbbing intestines or something. It's really just offensive to look at. But knowing the circumstances under which it was created, like, your heart breaks for it, because it feels like the person who created it kind of drew inspiration from some of their previous work, and they really tried their best under the most harrowing, difficult circumstances imaginable. And so the fact that it is a, like, visually, almost literally a steaming pile of shit, certainly a throbbing pile of shit.
That's horrible.
It's terrible. It breaks your heart. And, you know, you kind of want the sales, the secondhand sales of this game, the profits to just all go to this poor programmer. But no, that's not how it works.
I think it looks, I mean, the weird thing is, to me, it looks like it could have been quite good, because I think the central idea, I don't really understand the mechanics of it at a glance, but it looks like a combination of, like, I don't know, Tetris and or Puyo, like, you know, the falling puzzle game with Pipe Mania, which I love. Yeah. I love Pipe Mania. So sewing those two games together, it could work. But are you supposed to make complete circuits or something? Is that how you score? I don't understand.
It's been a while since I've played, and yeah, I've kind of tried to wipe it from my memory. So I can't provide. No, it's fine. I'm the one who brought it up. I can't give you a definitive answer, because my memories have deliberately become fuzzy about this game. But yeah, I do feel like there was something, I don't want to say germ, because I feel like that's too on the nose, some kernel of inspiration here that could have been, you know, developed into something good with more than a weekend of late night caffeinated programming to work with. If someone had given this programmer, you know, a couple of months, let them get up to speed on the Virtual Boy processor and video system, I think it could have been a really good game. But because Virtual Boy was a disaster, this game is kind of the capstone of the disaster. Mm-hmm. And now it is the crown excrement. Very sad.
And it'll cost you nearly $2,500 to experience.
Yeah. It's funny. I remember back when Chase the Chuck Wagon was considered the big rare game on the 2600, and that one was also made in a weekend by someone who just had no time or money. I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with this. They just sort of both link in that same spot in my head. Like, this was someone who had an idea and just not enough of anything to make it, like, come to fruition in time for when it was supposed to. But on the other hand, Chase the Chuck Wagon was not a retail product. Like, you know, putting this out on store shelves at full price just seems brutal.
Yes, well, it wasn't really out on store shelves for any appreciable amount of time, so I guess that's okay.
It was on a store shelf.
Yeah, somewhere. Right? Some mom-and-pop shop in the back alley of Akihabara. They got the three copies that were manufactured, and God bless the people who wandered in there and picked it up on day one or day 1,000, you know, whenever someone actually made it in there and said, oh, here's a Virtual Boy game I don't own. I bet this is going to be great.
No line out the door for Virtual Lab, huh?
No, not at all. Maybe a line to the bathroom to throw up after playing it. And then finally, we do have one more game. It barely qualifies for a white whale. Price charting says it's only selling for $2,000. That is the American version of Jack Brothers, which we've already kind of touched on, because it's got the Atlas and Persona thing going for it. It is, weirdly enough, the first Megaton game to have reached the U.S. It is a twin-stick maze shooter starring Jack Frost, Black Jack, and Jack the Ripper, the Jack brothers of the title, who are all minor demons that appear in the Shin Megami Tensei Persona series. And each one has different abilities, and they go through these mazes that are like multi-tiered, and they have to fight a boss. And each of the Jacks has different, in addition to like different elemental abilities, like different strength, different durability, different effects on their weapons. You know, like Jack the Ripper can only attack melee. Jack Frost can shoot ice beams. It's a cute little game. It's fun. I'm happy that it's going to make it to NSO. Virtual Lab, no, it is not. But Jack Brothers is, or Jack Bros, if you must. It's really solid, and I think more people should have a chance to play it because it's actually good, and is one of those games where you're like, I wouldn't pay $2,000 for this, but you know, I can justify the fact that I would own this as part of a complete collection because it's not an embarrassment that makes me sad. It is a weird, again, a very strange initial representation for the Megaton series for the US, but I guess it's the only one that didn't involve you fighting Jesus. So maybe that's how they snuck it in.
I mean, it sounds like it's got the historical Victorian, like, murderer Jack the Ripper as a playable character, which is something. Like, that's kind of crazy to me.
Yeah, you don't get that a lot in these games.
He's a pumpkin, though.
Oh, okay.
He's like a pumpkin in a black cloak with a hat.
You know, jack-o'-lantern. They never caught him, so he could have just been a pumpkin in a black cloak and hat in real life.
It's more likely than anything, I suppose.
So you're saying the movie Pumpkinhead was a documentary?
Mm. Yes.
Anyway, Virtual Boy coming to NSO, and because Nintendo couldn't make it reasonable and accessible for you, you have to buy a $100 accessory in order to play it. Even though it's a subscription-based service that they could pull at any time, leaving you with a chunk of useless plastic. But is it really a Nintendo system if you don't end up with a chunk of useless plastic at the end? Nintendo loves its short-lived peripherals, so I feel like this is very on-brand, and I'm very excited for more people to experience the actual good stuff on Virtual Boy, like Innsmouth no Yakata, and a few of those other games that tend to be pretty expensive, and also you have to play on a Virtual Boy, which is a persnickety piece of hardware. God bless Nintendo for almost getting it right here. So now we're moving on to the 16-bit era, and there's not as much stuff here for some reason, even though like the baseline price of, you know, Super NES games is very high relative to other platforms. There aren't a lot of games that just shoot way all the way up into the stratosphere as on the 8-bit systems. There are a few, but no, if you want expensive games, games that will make you question reality, question the wisdom of your existence, that's when you look to the Neo Geo Advanced Entertainment System. Not the MVS, not the console, the arcade machine, but the home console. Because when SNK launched the Neo Geo, it had a great idea. What if we did kind of like the Versus system or the Data East Deco system and created a generic cab that people only have to buy once to put into their arcade installation space? And then whenever they want a new game, they pay, you know, $1,000 or whatever, a few $100, and just put in a new board with some new decals, a new marquee, and you're good. You don't have to buy a multi-$1,000 arcade cabinet every time you want a new system. It's interchangeable. And because this arcade hardware is, you know, kind of a spec that is mass manufactured. It's based around the, it's a 68,000 processor, right, Kevin?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was a mass market machine. They said, why don't we also release this as a premium home console? Like, it's a very, very reasonable, super affordable arcade machine. And it will also be a really, like, high-end home arcades or home system to give you literally the exact experience you have in arcades at home, which, you know, only the rich kids had this. But it wasn't the idea behind the Neo Geo wasn't a home console. It was an arcade machine. And also, by the way, you can play this at home without having to buy a full cabinet. So in that sense, pretty smart. I think it was a good idea that people didn't necessarily understand. They just looked at the home price sticker and said, what the hell? But that wasn't really what they were angling for. So anyway, that's all well and good. The Neo Geo systems, the MVS in arcades and the AES at home, used identical code. They used identical games, but they did not use identical cartridges. There are separate cartridges for MVS and AES. And the weird thing is that MVS cartridges were more expensive at retail, you know, for vendors than the AES cartridges for home consumers. But in hindsight, in the aftermarket, that relationship has inverted. And MVS cartridges are a pretty affordable pickup, relatively speaking, within the Neo Geo universe. You can get just about any game cartridge as an MVS release, and it's going to be, you know, collector-grade prices, but rarely eye-watering. However, the home system releases, which were priced to be relatively cheap, are now crazy expensive, probably because so few people could actually afford to be Neo Geo AES owners and collect, you know, an entire console library when those console games each cost $200, $300 a piece, the cost of a competing console. So the scarcity of those games and desirability, because they are damn good and very impressive for a home console circa 1991, that's caused those prices to skyrocket. And now that I've explained the backstory, I'm going to let Kevin, the Neo Geo expert here, and also maybe Stuart, are you a Neo Geo expert?
Oh, no, God.
Okay, great. So we can let Kevin regale us with a walkthrough of these absolutely stupidly priced. Like, these are the most expensive things on this list, including the weird stuff for Atari 2600 and the limited release, you know, recalled games, promotional projects only for NES. No, Neo Geo official AES releases, they are the kings. They are the titans. They are the champions of making you sad about life. And weirdly enough, I expected that the European release of Kizuna Encounter would be one of these games. Supposedly only 6 copies of that release of that game for the AES exist. But no, it didn't even crack the top 10. So here's a game that collectors demand because only 6 copies exist. And yet the demand and price has not skyrocketed that particular cartridge to the top of the list compared to things that are actually pretty well known and you would think generally accessible and available. Kevin, I leave it to you.
You would think. Well, maybe that's why they're so accessible like now through, you know, every other platform known to man. So I will say I did have a friend back in the day. He was like in his mid-20s when the Neo Geo came out. So he was one of those people who was like, well, I have all this disposable income. I have no like family. I'm just going to pick up these things that I'm interested in as they come out. And even though he got every other Metal Slug game, he did not get this first one, which now sells complete for about $59,500, according to price charting. And that sounds very right, because even, you know, decades ago when I got into Neo Geo, like, as a platform, this was already, like, 5 figures when very little else was, and it's just kept going.
I find that, I mean, if you ask me, it's the best one of the Metal Slugs, which is, yes, you know, it's great, but there are so many ways to play this game. I mean, yes, they're not arcade perfect, and some of them are quite bad, but there are so many ways to play Metal Slug 1. I mean, you can buy it on the Switch for like $5 or something. I know that doesn't affect the original. I know it doesn't, but when these things get re-released, is it fair to say that it tends to affect the price of these things when they do get re-released? I just feel like with Metal Slug, especially, it's just so easily accessible that I just don't get why it would be this expensive. Did they hardly make any of them?
I think that was part of it, because, yeah, like, they didn't, the first game, like, it was, were they even owned by SNK at that point, the company that made this?
Nazca? I don't know. I think the purchase, the acquisition of Nazca, happened around the time of Metal Slug.
Yeah.
So Metal Slug was 1996, I want to say, 1995. I think by that point, the Neo Geo's fortunes and popularity as a home system, which were already slight, were really on the wane. And there was no reason for anyone to think, oh, here's a game called Metal Slug. I bet that's going to be really awesome. For a long time, whenever someone said Metal Slug, I always thought Viewpoint, like that was the game that popped in my head. I got those two Neo Geo games mixed up for some really stupid reason. No one could have guessed that it would be the most visually spectacular action, like Contra-esque shooter of all time. Like no one could have imagined that it would play really well, have lots of great ideas, a great sense of humor, really cool visual designs and bosses, just great set pieces, and utterly stunning detailed animation and bitmap art. Like, it is an exquisite game, yeah, both in terms of how it plays and how it looks. But, you know, who would have expected that in 1996, you know, as the next generation battle was just raging furiously between N64 and Sega Saturn and Sony PlayStation. This was just an afterthought. And so, yeah, I just don't think they made very many units, and I don't think very many people bought it, and now everyone is regretting it. But here's the funny thing. If you look on eBay, sold October 18th, 2025, SNK Neo Geo Metal Slug, cartridge only, unit only. I don't think they had boxes for these. The MVS near mint condition, 100% original and tested. How much do you think this MVS cartridge of the original Metal Slug goes for? Bearing in mind that the AES version is $53,000 complete, what is your guess for a working arcade cartridge of this exact same game? Literally the exact same code.
I'm going to guess $200.
Kevin Bunch, you are less than $4 off. Congratulations.
Oh, well done.
It's like you know this platform or something. Yes, that's right. You can own this game, arcade perfect, literally the arcade version of this game, for $200. And it's not that hard to find some sort of device to allow you to play MVS, like a Super Gun or something, to let you play MVS carts on a TV. So really, all you're doing by buying the AES version is just getting the packaging, which, you know, that's nice, and also getting a version that is inherently, like, natively compatible with your video game console. But otherwise, it is fully possible to play the arcade version of this game with a $200 investment, assuming you have the hardware for it.
Yeah.
That's just...
The
collectors,
funny part.
What are you doing?
The funny part is that MVS carts, including Metal Slug, used to be even cheaper, but, you know, because you can just get an adapter to use MVS carts on the home system, The collector market sort of realized, like, oh, why are we spending all this money on this stuff when we could just get, you know, a copy of Metal Slug or Mark of the Wolves for, like, $50? And now those have risen in price, but, you know, there's still so many copies floating around for MVS that it isn't too bad.
This is a question asked out of sheer ignorance. Is it with the MVS versus the AES? Is it like one of them's got like the dip switches or free play or something, and the other one doesn't? Am I imagining this? Like, I'm sure there was some sort of thing where There was one version that had like a 4-credit limit or something on it to make it more like it. That's the...
The home ones always have like a 4-credit. I think maybe there's a couple games that don't.
So I find this all very confusing.
is that actually a coding difference, or is it just something that when you plug it into an AES, the software says, oh, it's the home version, time to limit?
It's that. It's the same code. It's just looking for the BIOS for the arcade system or the home system. And if it finds the home system, it'll lock you to like those 4 credits. And if there's any like extra stuff for the home version, like an options menu or whatnot, you get to go through that.
That makes this even more inexplicable. Thank you.
that's most of the Neo Geo library. And, you know, the next game, I feel like, is also... it's also a Nazca joint, if I remember.
Yes.
And it's very understandable. This one was, what, pre-Metal Slug, I believe? Yeah, Neo Turf Masters, which has, like, a new, different name now because they didn't have the rights.
I think that's why this one has kind of gone up in price, besides the fact that it's a really damn good golf game.
Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah.
But it's Neo Turf Masters, and Masters is the official name of the PGA's tournament. And the PGA came after SNK and was like, hey guys, you want to pony up? And SNK said no. And now this is called something else. This game does not have Masters in the title anymore, which I have to say made my life a little complicated when I was putting together the bonus book for the limited run release of the Neo Geo Pocket Color Collection that had Neo Turf Masters Pocket on it, because I included photography of all the original games, you know, the boxes and everything, and SNK was like, yeah, you can't do that. So I had to come up with a workaround. Just, you know, for legal reasons. This was not something that SNK was being unreasonable about. I think it was something that SNK was like, hey, please, please don't expose us to legal concerns. I'm pretty sure I put the Japanese version on there, which, you know, it has the same art, but it's got a title in Japanese writing. So the PGA is like, okay, well, I don't know what the moon runes are. That's fine.
Yeah, this game, it's very good. All of these Neo Geo games, there's sort of like a price discrepancy between the Western and the Japanese releases. I feel it's particularly pronounced for this one. It's what, about 30,800 on average for the Western release, and then like 20,000, or a mere 20,000 for the Japanese. Because everyone knows.
Free.
Yeah, everyone knows it's a really good game. Especially at this point, it's got quite a reputation. It's from the same like masters of graphical craft who did Metal Slug, and you know, it's a Neo Geo game, so of course it's already going to be expensive. And this is another one where the MVS cart is basically, you know, bupkis in pricing, comparatively. This is not one that I have ever owned, or my friend who had all these Neo Geo games back in the day. He missed the boat on Neo Turf Masters.
Ah, alas. It's one of the best ones.
Yeah, I love this game. I think it's the game that made me realize that I quite like video golf in general. Like, it obviously is nothing like real golf in the slightest. It has none of the same required skills whatsoever. I mean, even with something like a soccer game, you could at least use some of the same tactics. But in video golf, oh no, not nothing at all whatsoever. It's like you're playing just a weird puzzle game that happens to be themed around golf.
And that's why golf is the only sports genre I like.
Yeah. It's why NES Open Tournament is one of my absolute favorite Nintendo games ever made. It's incredible. And this, it's like they take that kind of gameplay, but they actually streamline it even more and speed it up and make it more, I guess, for want of a better word, kind of arcadey. And it's got all these great insert images of the golfers looking like total badasses. Jeremy's, you can't see it like I can. Jeremy's doing the thing. And the amazing just sampled speech, like, on the green! It's just wonderful. I just wanted to gush about Neo Turf Masters a bit.
You know, special shout out to the Neo Geo CD version, which is both, you know, cheaper, because how couldn't it be? But also has an extra course in there.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
And it only takes like 30 minutes to load it.
Yeah. Or you can just put it on your mister and load it really quick.
So Kevin, where do you stand on the next game on the list? Stakes Winner. Is that the horse racing equivalent of Neo Turf Masters, or do we give a shit?
I'll be honest, I have never touched Stakes Winner because I don't really care about horse racing games. So this may or may not be good. It is certainly expensive. I got to give it that. What price chart?
How expensive is it?
$10,000, $250 on average. That's a lot of money for horse racing when there are many other horse racing options open to you.
Yes, you can buy some sort of Game Boy cartridge from Japan for probably 25 cents. That's much cheaper.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like this is one of those genres that just like it doesn't connect with Americans, and I don't know why it's very popular in Japan. It has to be, you know, some sort of cultural thing, but I don't know what that is. I don't know what it is specifically about horse racing that makes the kind of people who buy video games in Japan say, you know what? I want to make imaginary wagers on imaginary horses and then just watch the numbers unfurl. So it seems so profoundly boring and pointless to me, but who am I to judge other people's forms of entertainment? I mean,
I think all the time, but gambling, sure. I think when it's gambling, it's okay to be judgmental, to be honest. But so I want to get this straight here. You don't ride, you're not a jockey in this game. You just bet on the outcome of horse races. I haven't played it.
I'm looking it up, and you do, like, control the horse racers themselves.
Right, okay. But
and
you also, like, you bet on yourself, which is, of course, not allowed.
Yeah, I mean, Pete Rose got kicked out of the Hall of Fame for that.
Yeah. So what interests me about this list so far for Neo Geo, and again, this is quite an ignorant position. I got a lot of love for like King of Fighters and such, but I'm not broadly knowledgeable of the Neo Geo. I never had a Neo Geo. I never played on Neo Geo. I've seen them, but I've never got my hands on one before. The Neo Geo, well known for having quite a lot of one-on-one fighting games. Yes, I mean, that would say that was probably the lion's share of its library. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, and it was the 90s.
None of these so far are fighting games, and I wonder if it's maybe something to do with the fact that they are quite unique in the library, with the exception of Metal Slug, obviously, which has about a million different versions that make them more desirable. Like Neo Turf Masters, I think there's another golf game on there.
Yeah, but it's really bad.
I don't know. I do wonder about that. That's all.
Well, I think the fighting games were genuinely popular. So if you owned a Neo Geo at AES, you probably were going to buy, you know, the latest King of Fighters game. There was one of the big kind of features, the selling points of the Neo Geo platform was that you could take your memory card and transfer your saves between arcade and home. So that would allow you to take, you know, your scores and your character data for the fighting games and compete with people in arcades. So, you know, people would use Neo Geo AES as sort of a trainer for tournaments and things like that for competitive fighting. So I would have to imagine that stuff like King of Fighters and Last Blade were very successful by Neo Geo standards. So that's probably why they don't sell for as much, because there are just more copies floating around out there. Whereas, you know, dad games like golf and horse racing were probably not produced in large quantities, not sold that well. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if Stakes Winner, there's like triple digit versions of this around in AES form. I wouldn't be surprised if it were, you know, like extremely small numbers. And because, you know, because they were just basically doing a manufacturing shell variant on the existing arcade boards, it was very, I would guess very trivial for SNK to do a very small run of home releases and still have it make economic sense, because, you know, you go to order, like, retailers have pre-ordered X number of copies of this game, we'll produce that plus Y to make sure there's a little bit of overage for additional consumers. And, you know, we just do a run that's a variant of the existing manufacturing for the MVS, and we're good. You just have to produce the packaging for it, and that's it. And, I have to imagine that AES cartridges were kind of sold to demand. So when you have something that's less in demand, it's going to be produced less. And therefore, in hindsight, as collectors seek their complete libraries, will become more in demand. the terrible economic irony of game collecting.
Yeah, I feel like especially the post Aruze, you know, buyout, SNK, you know, revival era Neo Geo AES games in particular, those had very small print runs. I remember specifically you had to like order them on NeoGeo.com if you wanted them outside of Japan, where maybe they got a little bit of a retail presence. And they did not make very many of them, like a few hundred a piece. This last one we have here, Magical Drop 2. This is specifically the Japanese released it. I don't remember if this got a Western one at all, but the price charting price for this is about $12,000, which, you know, Magical Drop was very, like, well-known.
I like Magical Drop, but I don't like it $12,000 that much.
Yeah, it's kind of a nightmarish price tag. I can understand if you're, like, a Magical Drop head, why you would want to put that much money towards it, I guess. If you really, really love Magical Drop, they feel like I could find better ways to play it, especially in a world where the sequel exists, but hey, who am I to judge?
Yeah, we actually had the sequel in the lobby at 1UP.com in the early days. I don't know why or how it got there, but it was there. So if you wanted to play Magical Drop 3, you could do it for free if you were employed by Ziff Davis and had access to the 8th floor. So that's the Neo Geo. There's a lot of really expensive games, but I don't want to belabor the point. It all is pretty much the same pattern, like crazy expensive AES title, very, very affordable MVS title, cartridge variant. And tends not to be fighting games, tend to be more of the weird one-off puzzlers, other genre type experiences. Yeah, it's kind of the same shtick over and over again. Mm. I do want to give a special shout out here to the other obscure, unpopular 16-bit system, the TurboGrafx 16. And there is one game that almost hits the five-figure mark. Really, we can probably consider it an honorary five-figure game at this point. $9,600, I believe. My eyes are really bad. Yes.
Yeah.
$9,600 for a little game called Magical Chase.
And this is like a cotton style, kind of cute horizontal shooter.
Very,
type thing.
Very, yeah. Very cotton style. Developed by Quest, the company that gave us Tactics Ogre and whose talent gave us Final Fantasy Tactics. And there are little bits, like little aesthetic notes in here in the game where you're like, oh, the witches kind of look like the witches from Tactics Ogre. They kind of tie it in with that. It's not part of the same universe. It's a cute 'em up. It's really good. Is it $10,000 good? Nah, but it was one of the last TurboChip games released in the US by TTI. So late 1993, mid-1993, the system was on the way out. It must have been produced in crazy small numbers. This and Shockman were, to my knowledge, the last of the chip-based games. And then there were like three or four more CD-based games released over the next year. Just kind of dribbled out into the to the market, but this is the one that, for whatever reason, has picked up the real rarity and the real price spike. And I'm guessing because one, it's really good, and also it is a cute 'em up, which, you know, I have to imagine the fact that this even made it to the U.S. is remarkable. This is the kind of game that most companies in the 90s in America would have said, there is no way in hell this is going to sell. I mean, when I was at 1UP, like 10 years later, I remember some people came by with Twinkle Star Sprites, like a PS2 version of Twinkle Star Sprites, to get our feedback. Like, should we release this? You know, they were like, hey, Games Press, EGM, and 1UP, do you guys think we should bring this over to the US? Do you think anyone would buy this? It's really cute. It's good. But it's just, you know, super saccharine and colorful and kind of girly. Will Americans buy this? And they ultimately decided not to. So, you know, that's 10 years later. That's post-Evangelion, post Dragon Ball, post Sailor Moon, etc. Magical Chase was before all of that. And yet TTI was like, yeah, this system's not doing anything in America. Let's just put this out because it's fun. And God bless him for that. But now it is the Magical Chase piece for the TurboGrafx library. If you want this and Dynastic Hero, they're gonna make you regret life.
I think one reason why this version in particular is so expensive is because there are a lot of like improvements to it over the Japanese release, which is, you know, much cheaper but still expensive. Mostly like graphics, they touched up a lot of the visuals. I remember two things. One is that TTI was selling a lot of these late era games on their website in the 90s, and this was not one of them, so clearly whatever production run they had, they went through very quickly. And the other thing is, this is the game on this list I had the opportunity to get for $80 back around 2004, and I was like, I can't really afford that right now. I'll just get the next one I come across. And that has never happened.
This is a story that this has happened to you repeatedly, huh?
Yes, it was this, and Panic Restaurant was one. Samurai Showdown 5 Special was one, but this one hurts.
Sorry to hear that, Stuart. Do you have any fun, heartbreaking stories about Magical Chase?
No. Like really boring ones that are quite uplifting.
I like boring stories too.
Okay. Well, I forgot it in the 10 seconds since you asked, unfortunately. Sorry.
Amazing.
There are a lot of games that have names like Magical Chase. I could talk about Kid Clown and Crazy Chase for a bit if you like. It's similar.
Magical Crazy Chase, the Chuck Wagon. That's my favorite mashup. Good work.
We could do this all day. There are so many connections.
Well, we'll get the Pico 8 developers on it.
Oh, gosh.
There's a Game Boy Color port of this that I don't think came to America and is also very expensive, but not this expensive. Anyway, I was fortunate enough, friend of retro gaming and VGHF mainstay Steve Lin let me photograph his American TurboGrafx collection a few years ago for my videos and books. It was like 2/3 to 3/4 of the overall collection complete, which was very nice of him. And this was one of them that was in that collection. And so anytime in my video I mention like physical, you know, turbo chips, I tried out this image just because I'm like, I would never be able to photograph this game under any other circumstances. So I need to get maximum mileage out of the imagery that I captured of Magical Chase. It's not bragging. I don't own it. It's just like, oh my God, I'm so lucky. I just have to share my good luck with the world. I appreciate my good fortune and knowing people like Steve who are lucky and generous. So thanks, Steve. Just a few more things here, kind of winding down with some of the mainstream platforms. Nothing on Super NES or Genesis is going to come close to the extreme rarity of those NES, AES games for Neo Geo. But Super NES does have a couple of rarities, which, similar to the NES platform, besides Little Samson, are things that were produced for very specific non-retail purposes and are chase pieces for collectors who aren't good at drawing boundaries for themselves and saying, yeah, this was not sold in stores and I don't need it. I think you're making a horrible mistake, but you gave us content to talk about on this episode, so thank you for your madness. We appreciate it. The first of these is Nintendo Power Fest 1994, which is kind of like the Nintendo World Championship, except this one had, what, Star Fox on it or something like that?
No, this one, I think the original one had Star Fox on it, maybe. There was like the competition cartridge or something.
Oh, that's right.
This one is the Lost Levels, Super Mario Brothers Lost Levels, sorry, Mario Kart, and Ken Griffey Jr. presents Major League Baseball Home Run.
Right, of course.
I thought the Griffey game was on there.
Yeah, we're Griffin now.
All right. I I can't bring myself to care about these competition cart chase pieces, so I should have looked up the details in advance, but that's just me being negligent due to disinterest, sorry.
I do enjoy the disparity between the two Mario games and then Kangaroo Jr. presents Major League Baseball right? Home Run Derby.
They were really pushing that game.
Yeah. Who was Ken Griffey if not the American Mario? So this game is only available loose. They did not create packaging for it because why would they? It was something that no one was ever supposed to own unless they like won a copy probably through a competition. So the loose cartridge costs $17,550 according to price charting. And that's, again, the median price, not the high price, which is higher. And I don't have the stomach to look at those because it makes me sad sometimes. Anyway, if you want this, again, madness, but that's what you're going to be out. So get moving those crypto scams. Otherwise, I don't know how you're gonna build up that kind of cheddar. Another one. This one's even more esoteric. This was not consumer-facing at all. The Max Moving Target Simulator. So this one, I actually did read about because I was like, what the hell is this? I thought, you know, maybe this was like the mountain bike racing game under a different name. No, that doesn't even crack $10,000. This is $12,000. It says loose, but I think you also need the accessory, which was an actual honest to God, M16 that they turned into, this is my understanding, an M16 rifle that they turned into a, what the hell was the name of the light gun for?
The Super Scope.
Yes, the Super Scope. They like stuff Super Scope innards into a real M16 machine gun. And this was sold to the military to use for target practice. Jesus. So, they would learn to wield, you know, soldiers would learn to use an M16 with a Super NES system. And Super NES is not the only time this happened. This system existed from the early 1980s. I think it was kind of inspired by the success of Battlezone. And that's that game's use as a military simulator. So the military invested in Max Moving Target Simulators, MACS, by the way, not MAX, for a lot of different platforms, and one of them was Super NES. So there's a Super NES cartridge and a very special Super Scope that, you know, would make Golgo 13 very happy. I now want to own one of these M16s and ask the guy who brings NES games over to Super NES to bring Golgo 13 to Super NES so that I can play Golgo 13 with an actual M16. Suddenly $12,000 doesn't seem like such a bad investment after all.
When I was at Long Island Retro, I don't remember. I'm very sorry. I've forgotten your name, but I played,
Jeremy.
With this. No, not me. Wait, what was it again? Jeremy. Yeah. I played a Famicom thing. I don't know what it was called, but it was a light gun that actually sort of rattled like violently, like a big gun. And I had to go on Duck Hunt with it, and it was really funny because I like to imagine I was just using like a full auto high caliber Gatling gun to kill ducks. And what while I do disapprove of the military applications and question the usability of it, I would love to play Yoshi's Safari with an M16 so bad. Like, that would be so hot. Like, Mario sitting on the back of Yoshi just absolutely cutting people in half. Goombas, I guess.
The dream.
Yeah, that's Joe, I believe you're talking about.
Yes, Joe. Sorry,
his setup,
Joe.
Yeah. Every year he has this kind of, like, themed setup. But, yeah, he's been working on this project where he takes the... I can't remember the name of it, but it was a light gun that was released only in Japan for Famicom and had like compatibility with two games. And yeah, he's gotten that modified and reworked so that it works with other games. And it does, yeah, it does bring a little something different to the light gun genre on NES when you're playing it with something that resembles, you know, like a submachine gun.
Yeah.
Camera, it's like an Uzi or something. It's a little scary, but. But yeah, it's got the haptic feedback, so it kind of, you know, it's vibrates in your hand as
so
you shoot.
Cool. It's so, so cool. Yeah.
Yes, I also have a moral opposition to that sort of thing. But at the same time, you know, when it's just Duck Hunt or Gumshoe or whatever, it's fine.
Like, I want to capture the visceral, like, core adrenaline of killing a man without actually killing a man. That's the way to do it, I think. Get one of those guns.
Get one of those, play chiller with it.
Yeah.
Next we have Sega Genesis. There's only one game that really just is like catastrophically expensive. And it's the Genesis equivalent of that mountain bike racing game that I mentioned before. And the whole thing with this was that they were exercise games. You would buy a custom made exercise bike that, you know, plugged into your console, and then there was software that played along with it, and you would pedal as fast as you could in order to complete the game. So, you know, kind of like the a stationary bike version of the Power Pad for NES, or, you know, along those lines. There were a few others, like the that stupid force field thing. What was that called for Genesis?
U-Force? No, that's
it was the, like the circle that you activator. Put on the ground. Yes, the activator.
Oh, that God. Piece of shit, yeah.
Yeah, so Genesis had one of these bike racing games called Outback Joey.
Yeah.
And you were like a kangaroo that you controlled with a bicycle.
Yeah, it's like it's sort of like the kangaroo that Woody Allen had a fight with in that one movie.
I hope the kangaroo won.
I think ultimately it did, because the kangaroo hasn't really received any historical allegations. So yeah, I think
the kangaroo's not canceled.
Yeah. Yeah, but it was like the Heartbeat Catalyst, I think it's called, this thing it was packed in
yes,
with.
Yes, yes.
I had a look at this on YouTube, because you cannot play this. It has not been dumped or anything. There is no way to play this. And to be honest, I don't really want to put on the Heartbeat Catalyst, because I don't want to know what it says. So just like, no, I'm good. But having looked at this, this looks like exactly the sort of thing that if I had played it, I'd be on here telling you was really good. You know, it looks like a little mascot platformer where you jump around climbing trees, punching enemies. It looks fine. It just looks like a kind of Western Aero the Acrobat-ish, but, you know, obviously not as good as that, little platform game that just happens to tell you whether or not you've got coronary heart disease or whatever, don't they?
Yeah, I just last weekend I had dinner with a friend who works in museum archive game acquisitions, and he was telling me about how he stumbled across one of these, and you know, it's one of those where he's like, I have to justify the price of this, but we do need, you know, the Genesis collection complete. So we got to figure out how to make the money work, essentially. But this, according to price charting, this sells for $5,100, which I don't actually know. You know, they don't really say if that's just the game or if that is the game and the bike. You know, like I said, there is a Super NES equivalent of this, but it only sells for like $1,000 complete, which is still a lot, but not $500 or $5,000 complete. So I feel like, you know, in my efforts to chronicle the Super NES and Genesis libraries, I'm not going to bother with these. I might just say, you know what? I'm good. Thanks a lot. Good night. Any final thoughts on Outback Joey, Kevin?
Nope. I remember hearing about it back in the day and thinking it sounded very silly. And
correct.
Yeah.
But it does sound like it has more personality than the mountain bike game for Super NES. So shout out to the developers for saying, you know what's cool? Little kangaroo guys. Stuart, I know you agree.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, Carry the Kangaroo, that's it. The one that beat up Woody Allen, I guess. We already mentioned him, though. Oh, I think with the Genesis, unless I'm mistaken, the next rarest is like Musha or something, and that's like $800. So that's a big jump down. It's interesting, because you'd think that there would be more. Like, you would think there'd be something, but I guess the Genesis, while it is now retro, it's not quite vintage. Is that fair to say? We haven't quite reached vintage stage.
No, I just feel like there's not the collector demand for Sega stuff the way that there is, Nintendo for whatever reason.
Yeah, it's not a just world.
You know, the way, you know, a friend of mine, Kelsey Lewin, she co-owns a game store, well, a series of game stores. And I remember her once explaining that, you know, there's sort of a Nintendo tax, like anything that was on a Nintendo system is just going to end up being more interested or interesting to people.
Or is released now for the Nintendo Switch 2. Yeah.
So, like, even though the Sega Genesis was a pretty big deal, you know, at the time, like, comparatively to, you know, Super Nintendo collectors now, it's just not as big a deal. Which is probably why, like, only Outback Joey is the super rarity, because it's the game that has, like, a weird accessory that was not made in huge quantities. And
I guess in the end, it benefits me as a Sega fan in the end, ultimately, I guess. I have no interest in collecting for Super Nintendo, but I do have interest in collecting for Mega Drive. So, you know, double thumbs up over here. You guys keep being wrong about what's better, and I'll keep reaping the rewards.
I feel like part of this is because Nintendo has been a first-party console manufacturer for 40 years now in America. And so they have sort of been the incubator for 2-3 generations of nerds, and so many people's game affection and experiences are tied to Nintendo, whereas, you know, Sega dropped out more than 20 years ago and stopped manufacturing. So they just don't have that kind of crèche effect. So I think that has a lot to do with it. And, you know, I think we're starting to see that kind of come into effect with Sony. Like, PS1 games are starting to really, really take off in price. And I think that is because there is kind of like the generations that have been swaddled by Sony. You know, that's 30 years now. So you are starting to have that kind of sustained nostalgic effect that sort of comes out in aftermarket demand for games. So I feel like that's a really big part of it. And Nintendo is very good about knowing how to tug on the nostalgic heartstrings, whereas Sega, they've certainly activated Sonic fans, but I feel like they kind of struggle historically to convey the value and specialness of their games. So they're like, would they do something that's really consumer friendly? Like, here's a collection with 50 games on it for $30. That's amazing. Yeah. Like, as a consumer, hell yes. But, you know, Nintendo does the Disney Vault thing. They're like, we will, you know, we're titrating. We are doing a tiny little drip feed, and you are going to savor every crumb of nostalgia that we allow you. And, you know, I think that's very effective. So you can hate that strategy, and you're not wrong. But on the other hand, like, the results kind of speak for themselves. So yeah, I'm not endorsing those tactics, but I am saying that they're very good at psychology.
My feelings, without going into excessive detail, my feelings on it are very mixed. Because on the one hand, as a consumer, you're like, "Boo! I don't want to pay £60 for Mario Galaxy 2 again." You know. But on the other hand, on the other hand, I do feel like there are instances where, not on the other hand, it's kind of the same thing, really, as what you were saying. But the Mega Drive collection with 50 games in it, you know, amazing. But then when something like the Mega Man Legacy Collection came out, and people were complaining that it was only the first 6 Mega Man games for, like, what, like $15, $20, which is obviously a brilliant deal. It wasn't as good as something like Taito Legends that came out 10 years ago on Dead Hardware, because that had 60 games on it. You know, it's like, yeah, I kind of see that there needs to be a bit of a balance here in order to retain any kind of, not mystique, but any kind of sense of value of these games. There need to be more than just a list of ROMs that you go down and open and go, I don't like this.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think Digital Eclipse is doing great work in that regard by saying, yeah, we're going to give you a few games and they're full priced. You know, you have like the Atari 50 collection, and there's a shit ton of stuff in there. But some of their other collections are, you know, they're more curated, but everything is an experience. And it really, like, it feels like they're doing a great job of saying, like, this is why this collection of 5 games is worth $50. Because, you know, here's the history. Here's the player experience. You know, here is something that we have carefully crafted for you to enjoy. So Yeah, it's got to be one or the other. The point is, I don't think Sega has quite hit that mark yet. Although, God, those Sega Ages collections by M2, not the collections, but just the individual games, those should have been the point, the tipping point where people were like, I mean, for me, it was. I was like, Sega Ages is what made me stand up and say, I've been wrong about Sega all this time. I do love them. I just didn't know it. But most people are not giving those collections the love and devotion that they should. And they're wrong and mistaken, and they should feel bad. This is my official stance. So anyway, let's wrap with one last game on a Sega system. And this one I know nothing about. It's a Sega Saturn game. And some of those are pretty expensive now because the Saturn was poorly distributed, sold poorly, badly managed in the US, just kind of a disaster all around.
Poor thing.
But this one, I know, it deserved better. It's like the TurboGrafx. Like on the Japan side, so good, so rich, so accessible. On the American side,
tons of shooters on both. So if you like that genre, you are swimming in good times.
So price charting says this game sells for 9,000 American bones. That is a lot of bones.
Yeah.
It is called Daytona USA CCCE Netlinks Edition. Kevin, you made a note here. Please walk us through this. Tell us. What is this horrible white whale that so many Saturn devotees have lashed themselves to as the Pequod sinks?
Yeah, so, you know, the Sega Saturn, as one of its big releases, was a home port of the arcade game Daytona USA, which was a pretty solid port, you know.
Had a great song.
Great song. Pretty decent game. And then in Japan, they released an updated version, I believe. I forget what it's called exactly. And this is sort of like the American equivalent of it in a lot of ways. Like, technically, it added in greater draw distance. It had some tweaks to the mechanics and the audio that make it a little more like the arcade game. Also, they added in net play, you know, over the your 56K modem or what have you. And I think the reason why this was so expensive is that it's a late Saturn game and they only sold it through mail order, which is, you know, kind of the kiss of death for anything that you want to buy 30 odd years later.
Yeah, it's like if the original Daytona USA, like from 95, it's like the AM2 version and it's very highly acclaimed. And in terms of sort of car handling, it's pretty much spot on for the arcade. It feels exactly like playing the arcade game. And then there's a bit of, I don't know if scuttlebutt is the right word, but like that when they released the following year, I think it was, as you mentioned, the Circuit Edition, that did get a worldwide release. And that was like, they did make some improvements, but they also changed the handling and it feels less like the arcade game. So people don't really like that. Then a year after that, it comes out in Japan and it's that, but they have sort of fixed the handling and put it back. And that's 97. And then 98 for 1/4 and final release of the same game. Ultimately, they put that out as the Netlink edition. And it's discovered that the Netlink edition is the Japanese edition. So that for handling has been fixed. So that makes it more desirable, even besides its sort of rarity, it actually does have gameplay value. Because it's the fixed version with the new stuff, but also, yeah, it's probably the best version. And yeah, you can't have it. Sorry.
Yeah, you know,
I didn't want it to begin with.
As far as I can tell, this is really like the last big expensive game, both because, you know, the collector markets are just catching up to you know, the early 2000s era. But also, I feel like game print runs since then just have not been so restricted.
Mm-hmm.
At least not for anything people really care about. So,
except that, you know, the Super Mario 3D collection, which was discontinued from sale a few weeks after it went up for sale, so that Nintendo could sell you Super Mario Galaxy for $60 a generation later.
Naturally.
Thanks, Nintendo.
I have a copy of that, like, well, sealed on my shelf, and I'm waiting until I can sell it and just buy a house outright. That's my current plan.
It's getting there. So this has been the recap, the return of the White Whales, and there are probably things that we could talk about beyond here. All kinds of collector stuff. If you look in the computer space, big box games, arcade machines, but it's easier just to kind of keep it narrow. Like, you know, collectors, you need to keep your vision kind of restricted and bounded so that you don't go off into Outback Joey territory or, you know, something worse. And likewise, we need to keep our topics focused so that this doesn't become like a 12-part series. So this is it. Second part, followed up a mere month after the first edition. Wow, a new Retronauts record. We did it. Congratulations, us. I guess, you know, that's the capitalism scared us into effectiveness. So this is a bonus episode, a patron-only episode. And that means I don't need to tell you, the listener, how you can support Retronauts because you already do, and that makes you awesome. Thank you for spending your money to subscribe to Retronauts on Patreon, as opposed to putting it all into a copy of Metal Slug for AES. It's a much wiser choice. And I think, you know, 10,000 months from now, when you could have saved that, used that money for buying the AES cart, you'll thank us. So, again, thanks. You're awesome. Kevin, where can we find you on the internet? Give your bona fides.
You can find me under Atari Archive on Blue Sky, on the web, on YouTube. That's also the name of my book, which is available through Limited Run and is quite good. You should totally pick it up.
All right. Sorry, not Kevin. Stuart. Yes, the other one.
The other one. hello,
your name's right there. It was confusing.
No, I understand. We were all confused about each other's names today. Yes, hello, I'm Stuart Jip, and I'm not sure when this episode is going to go out, so I won't mention the Kickstarter because I imagine it will be over by then. But
It's going out November 14th.
Okay, all right. It will probably just about be running. So you have, as of hearing this, you have like 1 hour to go and back Nez Book on Kickstarter. It's a thing I'm working on with Ninty Media. I've done things like Gamebook Color. Lots of books, basically. Trusted hands there. Trusted hands. You should go and put like all of your money on it. I mean, you're not going to be able to afford any of these White Whale games, but this is much more affordable. You know, you could get a copy of this book and it's quite big. You could probably brain someone with it. That's always cool. And you could also buy my first book, All Games Are Good, which you could also brain someone with, but in a slightly stealthier way.
All right. And you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, at Retronauts, at YouTube as Jeremy Parrish, at Limited Run Games, secretly working and lying to you about bringing some of these games back into the public sphere. I'm not responsible for it, but I am involved as much as I can be because it's cool. And am I doing anything else? Oh, yeah. I have a book you can pre-order called Metroidvania the First Decade. You can get it at Barnes & Noble or other bookstores or even at a comic shop. I still love the idea of you going to a comic shop and saying, I want this book. Put it in my pull bin, and I will be in your pull bin sometime in March. So please check that out. It is based on my YouTube series, Metroidvania Works, but greatly expanded, all kinds of new games added, all kinds of every article rewritten, new sidebars, chronologies, indices, glossaries. It's comprehensively reworked. It was published through Dark Horse. And they put me through the paces to make it awesome. So be sure to check that out because you love Metroidvanias, the genre that is not super expensive because it's so good. Everyone loves it and easily shares the knowledge and wealth of these games with others. Thank you. Yes, good night. This has been Retronauts. We're done talking now. Go play some games that hopefully will not bankrupt you.
Ooh.